Okay, we're going to begin the Gemara Mem Daled Amud Aleph. The Gemara is now continuing its discussion of the Braisa that it brought at the top of Mem Gimel Amud Bet, which is Tan Rabbanan, Machar lo Bayit, Machar lo Sadeh, Ein Me'id lo Aleha. He's not allowed to testify on behalf of the individual, because the responsibility for that property resides with him. Now, the Gemara came and brought the words of Rav Sheshet that tried to explain that convoluted case, and that Rav Sheshet says is Reishib Reuven shegazal sadeh mishimon. Reuven stole property from Shimon, who's the rightful owner. Umachrad Levi, and then he sells it to Levi. At Yuda, totally independent party Yuda comes kamarer, and he's making a claim against Levi. So now Shimon does not, the original owner does not have a right now to go support the case of Levi against Yehuda because it provides him some benefit. The Gemara went through all the different permutations of why it works or why it doesn't work, what exactly the case is. Now the Gemara says, why do you have to go through such a convoluted case? For look, Mabi Gazlan. Just simply set up the case as being as Gazlan. Why do you have to be, or why does the case have to be that Reuven stole from Shimon and then sold it to Levi? Why don't we just have it? Reuven stole from Shimon. Now, Shimon can't go and testify on behalf of Reuven against Yehuda or against any other party that comes to make a claim against Reuven. So where it says, Mishum tekobay the mitna sefer machar lo para machar lo talit. The reason that we need to explain the Reisha case, the case where he also there's a, some sort of sale that transpires in the case, is because the second half of the Braisa requires a sale to be there. What's the second half of the Braisa? The second Braisa is machar lo para. If he sold him metaltalim, he is allowed to testify in that case, because he gets no personal benefit in that instance. So where it says that is dafka machar, so this is something that we discussed in the Gemara in Baba Kamo. The Gemara in Baba Kamo has a machlokas as to what allows ownership to transfer. For instance, when property is stolen. What is it that allows now the ownership to transfer? Why does it make a difference when the ownership transfers? Well, in a stolen object, if the ownership has not transferred, then the object must be returned to the original owner. On the other hand, if the ownership is transferred, then you do not have to give the original object back. You have to compensate in kind or in cash what you took from the item, but you don't have to return the item itself. So what constitutes a change in ownership? So the Gemara, there's actually a three-way machloket in the Gemara, but there's one opinion that says Yeush Kadi, that Yeush by itself, that when the original owner gives up hope of getting it back, that is sufficient to generate a change in ownership. The other Deya is that it's Yeush Vishinui Rishut, that it's giving up, number one, hope, the owner has to give up hope, and number two, it is that Shinui Rishut, it has to actually change possession. Has actually physically changed possession from the original owner to someone else's possession. So that the combination of Yeush and Shin Rishut generates the change in ownership that will permit him not to return the object, but rather to pay the money back. The last opinion, which is actually what the Gemara seems to be after here, saying even according to this opinion, is that you need Yeush and then Shin Rishut. Meaning that the Shin Rishut, the change in ownership, has to take place after the Yeush, after the original owner gives up hope. So that's what the Gemara says over here. The reason we need in that case of machar lo para, machar lo talit, a case of machar, a case of selling, is because then we have yeush, the original owner gave up hope of getting it back. And number two is we have shinui rishut. In that case, we have a change in ownership because he sold the object. He first of all took the object, what it seems to be that he stole the object. Now he sold the object. So now you have yeush, the original owner has given hope of getting it back. Plus now he sold it to a third party. So now you have Yeush and Shinui Rishut, the original owner will not get it back. So now when the original owner goes and testifies on behalf of any individual who has the property now, he has no vested interest in it because he's not going to get the property back. He's only going to get the compensation, but he's not get the property back. So obviously, this is what the Rashbam says. Obviously, this is a case, Shelo B'Achrayut. When he sold the object, the parah, the talit, sold the metaltim without any recourse. So nobody can come back and get the money from him. If there is recourse in the sale, then obviously the owner has a vested interest here because someone's going to come back and take it from him. Now that is the whole point of the Braisa. The Braisa is going to teach us when the object is stolen and then sold, there will be a difference between karka, between real property and metaltalim. Why is that? Because in karka, when it comes to real property, he cannot testify. For instance, again, the case is Reuven steals from Shimon and then sells it to Levi. Here, Shimon could not testify on behalf of Levi against a third party that comes in, questions Levi's ownership here, for instance, Yehuda, because in that case, he is no Gebe Edut. There he has a personal vested interest in the property remaining with Levi. Why? Because Ein Yeush v'Shinui Rishut Mo'il B'Karka. By real property, Yeush and Shinui Rishut are irrelevant. Why are they relevant? Because takarka ain't an exelot. Karka cannot be stolen. Since karka can't be stolen, it remains in the possession of the original owner, and Shimon's possession. And therefore, if he testifies on behalf of Levi, there is a benefit to him because the property will return to him. Since it's never stolen, there's never any hope given up, and there's no shini reshut when it comes to karka, and therefore this karka ain't an exelot, and you'll get the property back. Now the Gemara gives cases where it won't work, or where he is no ge'e be'eduto, which are the cases where keeping the property in his hand will help him or benefit him because of the status quo remain, or we have the first answer of the Gemara is that he has a vested interest in keeping Levi's hands over Yehuda's hands because he can deal with Levi and he can't deal with Yehuda. So that's when it comes to karka. But when it comes to metalta, when it comes to non-real property, when it comes to those items that are movable items, then he can't testify on behalf of this buyer, meaning Levi, who bought it from Reuven, who had stolen it from Shimon. Shimon can now testify on behalf of Levi. Why? Because you have Yeush and Shinui Reshut. And therefore the object will never return to him. If it's never going to return to him, then of course he can testify. Again, this is all done when there is no achrayut, there is no recourse. The reason you have to say it's shlo b'achrayut, that he sold it without recourse over here, and this is what Tosfos comments in the Pshat of the Rashbam, is because otherwise, Shinui Reshut and Yeush should not make a difference here. Even with Yeush and Shinui Reshut, Shimon should be able to go back to Levi and just take the item away. Why? Because Levi loses nothing by him taking the item. When he takes the item, Levi can go back to Reuven and get his money back. So since he gets his money back, there's no loss to him by Shimon taking it back. So in that case, we'll still take it. But in a case where Levi will not get compensated for the item and take away, then we're going to say, no, Yeush v'shinui reshut, that's a protection of lekuchot. We have to protect buyers. Otherwise, nobody's going to buy anything anymore because they're always going to be afraid that it's going to come and taken out of their hands because it was stolen somewhere along the way. So there we afford protection. We say there's Yeush and Shinui Reshut. At that point in time, the object's now cleared away from the Nigzal, from the original owner. And the person who bought it, like Levi, can keep it. Now Reuven will be on the hook because he stole it from Shimon. You have to pay him the money, but that the object will go back. Tosfos does question at this point the Rashba's assumption when we explain that by Karka, there's no such thing as Yeush by Karka. It says, he quotes the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi says there is Yeush by Karka. If there's Yeush by Karka, then what's the chiluk here between Parah and Talit and Karka? Because once you have Yeush, both of them leave the possession of the original owner. And then even in that instance, the original owner should be able to testify because he's not going to get the property back. So Tosfos says that in Ochanami, you could have differentiated. Truthfully, the case by Karka is a case where there is no Yeush. There is no Yeush. And that's why he's able to keep, they can't testify in the case of the Karka because he was not Miayish. Tosfos says, if that's the case, why do you have to even bring Karka? And you could explain the whole case by Parah and Talit, by Metaltalin. When a case where he is miayish, in that case, he won't get it back, and he's not nogea beituto, he doesn't have personal vested interest, and therefore he can testify. In a case where there is no yeush, then he does have personal interest, because he will get the object back, and therefore he can't testify. Tarsus says, eno chanami, that's what you could have, the Gemara could have been mechalik that way, but it would rather do something that's milto de shchicha, that which is normal. Generally, people don't have yeush when it comes to karka, and they do have yeush when it comes to metaltalim, so the Gemara set it up, and they, what would be seem to be the plausible case of when there is Yeush and no Yeush. Now the Gemara says, wait a minute. Tana Reisha Nami. So we said, the reason that we had to write Mecha, we had to come with this convoluted case about Karka of it being stolen and then sold, is because if you had simply just talked about a thief, you would not have Yeush and Shinui Reshut. So we want Yeush and Shinui Reshut in order to generate the separation between the original owner and the current holder of the item or the property, in order that he won't be no gabiutut, he won't be personal interest. That's true by mentality. So Gemara says, okay, fine. That's why they did it in the Reisha. Right? Because if they were not Mocher, it would be Hadrele, it would go back. So the Gemara says, look, so Tana Reisha, Nami Mecher. So therefore, in the Reisha, in the case of Karka, it also wrote about Mecher. Gemara says, oh wait a minute. Say for this case of Metaltalin, Nami, Nehi, Demiyayish, Migufe, Midme, Mimeyayish. Wait a minute, you're suggesting that he has no personal interest in the object anymore because he's given up hope, there's Shinui Reshut, and there's Yeush, so therefore he's not going to get the item back. You're right, he's not getting the item back, but he says, if Yehuda comes along and is successful in his court case against Levi, then it's going to prove that Shimon had no rights to this object. He doesn't have any rights to the object, he has no claim against Reuven. So by keeping it in the hands of Levi, he has now a valid claim against Reuven that the object was stolen. So the Gemara says, lo, tzricha demit gazlan. It's a case where the gazlan himself died. Right? Why? Detnan. A gozel machilip benav v'niach lefneim p'turim milashalim. So the gazlan dies. In that case, he's not going to get his money back. Because both the object, he's not getting back, because there was Yeush and there was Shinui Rishut, so it's changed ownership hands. All right, so now he's entitled to get compensation. He may not get the object, but he's entitled to compensation. That's only true if the Gazlan is still alive. But once the Gazlan dies, he has no right to compensation either. Why is that? Because we have a Mishnah that states, a Gozel Machlif Benav, someone who steals and gives and feeds that to his children, Beniach Lifnehem, or he left it for them, Pturim L'Shalem, they do not have to pay it back. So since they don't have to pay it back, he's going to get nothing now. He's not going to get compensation. He's not going to get the object back. So therefore, he can go and testify on behalf of Levi, or it's really now Levi's children, because he's not going to get anything back. The Gemara says, V'lukma bar Yoresh. So why, if that's the case, why don't we just set up the whole case here by a Yoresh, case of the inheritor? Why do you have to set up the case of Mecher, being a case of sale? Just say it is. Reuven stole it from Shimon, and Reuven then dies, and his Yerushim, his children, take it. So now you have everything you need. You have Yeush, because we assume that Shimon gave up hope of getting it back when it was Reuven's hands. And you have Shina Rishut, because it went from Reuven to his children now. When it went from Reuven to his children, that's a Shina Rishut. So now you have Yeush and Shina Rishut. You don't even have to create a sale here. Why don't we use the case of Yoresh? Where it says, Hinicha the Mandamar, that works well, according to one who says Rishut, Yoresh, Lav Ki Rishut, Yorokeach Dami. That a inheritor is not similar to a buyer or purchaser of property. It's not classified as a Shinui Rishut. It's not classified as change in ownership or change in who possesses the item. Because we look at a Yoresh, the Kari de Avuahu, that he's an extension of his father. He's an extension of his father, as if it remains in the same possession. So if that's the case, then we can understand why we didn't explain the Brisa, or the Brisa didn't use the case of Yoresh, of an inheritor, because an inheritor is not like a lokech, like a buyer. If you use Yoresh, then you're missing one of the factors that would make him not nogea beedutan. Listen, the fact that it would make Sam not have a personal vested interest here is because there was Yeush and Shina Rishut. But without the Shina Rishut, you don't have that factor. So according to one who says that Yoresh is not like lokech, that makes sense. But we have another day out. The man damar Rishut Yoresh ki Rishut lokech. According to one who says that a Rishut Yoresh is Karishut Lokeach, Mayikul Meimar. How you can explain this Breisha? Why can't you explain the Breisha as a case of Yoresh instead of a case of a sale? Vote Kashalit Abayin. And an additional question is, Mipneisha Akrayuto Alav. Our Breisha back on Mem Gimel Mibed says, this explains the Gemara, Tarabanan, Machlo Bayi, Machlo Sudan, Emi Lo Alav, Mipneisha Akrayuto Alav. Because the Akrayut is on him. Now, the way we're explaining Akrayut over here is different than anywhere else in Shas. Whenever you talk about achrayut over here, we're talking about the mocher. The seller took upon himself obligations, meaning recourse. And that's what the word achrayut means. Over here, that's not what we're trying to define the word. The way Rav Sheshi is explaining the Braisa, the word achrayut over here means that the original owner has no vested interest over here. That's the way we're defining the word achrayut. And that's different than anywhere else that we've used it in Shas. So why should we say that? Because he accepted recourse or didn't accept recourse. That's irrelevant to this case. It's the whole issue is whether he's going to get the object back or not get the object back. It has nothing to do with the recourse that he accepted, but rather whether he's going to get it back or not. So now you're trying to tell me the word achrayut here means that he's going to get it back or not get it back? That's a different definition than what we've seen throughout Shas. So based on that, the Gemara is now going to have to come up with a different solution or different explanation of the Braisa. Now, just as a little side note, the one who says that Rishut Yoresh Lav Rishut Lokeach Tameh, that an inheritor is not like a purchaser of property, therefore there's no Shinui Rishut, then has he explained the Mishnah in Baba Kama? The Mishnah in Baba Kama says, a Gozel Machilip, and if someone steals and gives it to his children, and or leaves it for them, then they don't have to pay. Why not? All you have is Yeush here. You're missing an essential factor for having them not be obligated to return it, which is Shinui Rishut. So the Gemara over there explains that according to that Manda Amra, who says that Rishut Yoresh is Lav Kelokeach Tameh, he has to explain the Mishnah, a case where the item was already consumed. It has no longer exists. Since the Yorshim already ate it, or his children ate it, therefore they have no obligation to return it. If the object was extant and still around, they would be obligated to give it back because there's lack of Shinui Rishut. Once they've eaten or consumed the object, then the monetary obligation does not, or the monetary obligation to compensate for the object does not devolve upon them. It does on their father, but not upon them. And that's how we explain the Mishnah in Baba Kama. Now, so the Gemara has to continue. Ella, Kid Rabin Bar Shmuel. We have to explain this Braisa back on Mem Gimel Bibet, like Rabin Bar Shmuel. Damar Rabin Bar Shmuel, Mishmet Shmuel, Mucha Sadeh Chaver Shalom Be'achroyut. Someone who sells a field to his friend without recourse, a maid, though he cannot testify on his behalf, because it helps him to have it in the hands of the individual that he sold it to. Why is that? Because again, we discussed this yesterday, when it comes to selling something or making yourself a disinterested party in a certain property or object, that only works from heretofore, meaning going forward. That's true that you have no vested interest. But what is not true is that any transaction that preceded the point in time where you released your ownership from the object, right, that they can. Someone there does have the ability to go and take the property. For instance, if you had a creditor before you sold this property, if you had a creditor before they sold this property, then he has a first lien or first right to this property. And he can go to the buyer of this property and take that out from him, that property from him, and satisfy his debt. So in this case, where you've taken no achrayut, they've taken no recourse, there's no recourse back to the original owner, there is a benefit to you to see it stay in the hands of the individual who purchased it from you, because when it stays in the hands of the individual who purchased it from you, then your balchov, your creditors can go and fulfill or have their debts paid back by that land, and you have no obligation to the person who bought it from you because you sold it to him without achrayut, without any recourse. So that's exactly what this Bryce is discussing over here. So the Gemara says, why? V'dafka bayit osodet. That's only true of real property. When you sell real property, then the balchov, your creditor who preceded this transaction, could go after that property because it is real property. Avalt bahariya para v'talit. But in a case of metaltalim, of non-real property, that is not true. Why? Because non-real property is not meshubat. We have a general principle that when it comes to real property, when you have a lien on real property, the lien stays with the property no matter where it goes. Because that type of lien or that type of transaction has a kol, and the buyer beware. Buyer has to look into these issues, and he should be aware of these issues, and he shouldn't purchase it unless he knows for certain that it's free and clear. Whereas when it comes to a para and talit, it comes to metaltalim, we can never track the type of lien that's on this property, because they're movable objects that get sold, that get moved around. It's impossible. There's no call for such a type of lien. Therefore, when they're in possession of the debtor, the creditor can come and take them. But once the debtor has sold them, you can't go after those objects. And that would be exactly the difference in the Braisa. When it comes to Machalo Bayit, Machalo Sadeh, he can't testify it Mnei Shachriyatu Alav, because in that case, the Achayut is on him, meaning that the obligation as a seller, he has a benefit from that because it now can revert back to the original creditor of the seller. Whereas when it comes to a para and talit, he can testify on behalf of the person who holds the object now, because a creditor, the person's creditor, the seller's creditor, can never go after that para and talit. And if that's the case, he has no vested interest in keeping it in the hands of the individual who bought it from him, because he gets no benefit from that. So therefore, in those cases, he can testify. Gemara says, Lomi bai, that is not only true by a paran talit when he said bestama, that he just made a plain lien on the property. There we know metaltalin are not mishubad, there is no lien on metaltalin, on non-real property. Because my time, metaltalin, you know, that's exactly right, they move around. Nobody is sumich to have a lien or to take collateral from something that is going to move or can be taken away. But when it comes to metaltalin, movable objects, non-real property, they are not subject to liens to from a balchov, from a creditor. Even though when you write the contract, you say that the creditor has the right to collect even from the coat on your back, that's true. That's only true when it's still in the possession of the debtor. He can take anything. He can take your land, he can take your clothes, he can take anything he wants to fulfill his loan or to fulfill the debt. Once you've got rid of metaltalim, you've sold objects that are movable or non-real property, lo, then he can't go after them. Ella, so that we know is true by metaltalim. But the Gemara is going to take one step further and say, Ella, filu asoa putuke namilo. Even if he makes the metaltalim, the non-real property, what we call directed collateral, he says to the creditor, you can only collect out of this object. It's directed collateral for this loan. Nevertheless, if he sells it, it removes the lien on the object. Why? Because my time, because we have a principle of Rova, the Amar Rova, Asava do potuki, if he makes his servant a directed collateral for a loan, umecharo, and then he sells it, balchov govemenu, the balchov can go after that evit. Sharov, chamoro, apotuki, if he does that with his animals, umecharo, and then he sold it, ein balchov govemenu, the creditor can't go after that object, my taima, what's the difference between, they're both metaltalin over here, they're both objects that move around or can be sold, and we don't say it like karka that they belong to the original owner. Why? So why over here? What's the difference? Hayit lekala, le dekala. The difference between a para and a talit is that a para and a talit are objects that don't have a kol. When they're sold, it's not well known, and nobody knows that there are liens on them. These are objects that move around or have transacted with that don't have a clear chain of ownership. That's not true of a karka of land, real property. It's not true of an evet, because those are types of items that people, first of all, are well aware of. There's a kol, there is a, right, both a rumor mill, we call it a grapevine, where people know that these types of objects have been sold, because they're significant objects. And also, these are the type of things that generally don't move around so much. I mean, the karka stays, and avadim generally stay with one individual, a couple of individuals. They don't just freely move around. They're a human being. They're people that are distinct and discernible, and therefore they are classified as something that has a kol, and it's something that we expect the lokeach, the buyer, to be aware and to figure out that there's a lien on these items, but not in the case where it's a metaltalin. And that's how we explain this whole brisa that we saw before, the clear differences between real property and non-real property. And the difference between real property and non-real property is whether the lien of the creditor survives, right, the transaction. If the lien of the creditor survives the transaction, then the seller cannot go testify on behalf of the buyer because the creditor still has an interest there, and so does the seller, because if his creditor fulfills the obligation with that sold object, then he's covered. Whereas in a case where the lien will not survive the transaction, then we say that the seller can go and testify on behalf of the buyer because he gains nothing from it. His creditors can't go after this object anymore, and therefore keeping it with this individual is not going to do him any good. So Gemara says, wait a minute, well, this isn't the end of the game, because v'ha lechush dilma akne le metaltle agav mekarke. Let us say this. Why don't we suggest that he did create a kinyan, he did create a lien on the metaltle? Why? So we say that liens only apply to real property, but not to non-real property. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is that if you give the lien on the property, but you also gave it to sold with that, or with created that lien with metaltalim agav karke. This is a principle the Gemara in Kedushin, or the Mishnayot in Kedushin, talk about. And when it comes to kinyanim, right, you can cut bikone karka, right, through shtar, kesef, and chazakah. Metaltalim, we know you can be kone through mishicha, hagbad, or other different kinyanim. But if you are kone metaltalim, it doesn't do anything for you with regards to real property. If someone sells you both real property and non-real property, if you're kone the non-real property, it doesn't help you with the real property. The other way is not true. If you're kone real property, if you're kone land, then along with that land, you can also be kone items that are non-real property. So even though it's using a kinyan that only functions for real property, along with it, it'll drag along all the non-real property. So give an example like that is if you buy a field, and the individual says, you know what, I'll give you a wheelbarrow and a hoe and a rake along with the field. If you're kona the field, right, then you get the other objects along with it because the kinyan for the field suffices for all those objects. So to over here, when it comes to a lien, the same is true. If one has a lien or is able to create a lien on real property, now if someone along with that property gives non-real property as part of the collateral, the two can be enjoined. And therefore, if the baal chov, the creditor, gets the lien on the property, along with that, he will also get a lien on the metaltalim. It's amigo. That's what the Rashi says. Amigo de chal shibud makarke chal nami metaltalim. Just like the shibud functions or is able to be set upon the real property, it also works on the metaltalim. But on the other way, if you just use metaltalim by themselves, non-repo by themselves, over there, like tenya kinyan sudar, kinyan chalipin, or kinyan mishicha, there, you can't create a shibud on the property. You can't keep a shibud on that non-real property because they are basically conditional, which is that if I collect, then it will be, if I collect the money from you, then this item will be free. If I don't collect the money from you, I'm going to take this item. So that's basically a kinyan that is done al tanai. A kinyan al tanai is basically a smachta. It's a smachta. It's something where there's not gemira to dat. The person is not certain that the transaction will go through. Why is he not certain? Because the creditor might pay the money back, and then he won't keep the collateral. On the other hand, if he doesn't pay the money, he'll keep the collateral. So him making a kinyan, the creditor making a kinyan on this object, is not a valid kinyan. That kinyan doesn't help him up front, because the kinyan is a kinyan of uncertainty, and that doesn't make it a good kinyan. Whereas when you do a kinyan on karka, and you create collateral through karka, we know that kinyan, or we know that lien on real property works. So if he has a lien on the real property, he can also, through that real property, also have a lien on non-real property. So now we have a problem, because Because anybody who sells an object, we should be afraid. When they sell the object, he shouldn't be able to testify on behalf of the buyer, because there's always a possibility that he has a vested interest in the object. Even though his creditors can't go off after the object independently, but if his creditors had a lien on his property, and then through that they also had a lien on the easement, then he is no gay about the fire. So the Gemara says, what about that? Dama rabo, iakne le metaltle ga makarke kani. Makarke kani. Makarke kani metaltle. Right, so, I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Dama rabo, iakne le metaltle ga makarke. So if someone is kone, metaltle along with karka, kani makarke kani metaltle. Or, gova mi karke, gova mi metaltle, whatever way the girsa reads. But the fact is that the, through the real property, can also drag along the metaltle and the non-real property. That when he does this, when he creates such a lien, he has to say that there is no asmachta here, that this is not a case of asmachta, because since it's not a full sale, but rather, and not a gift, it's a mashkon, it's collateral. So he has to say that when I'm giving you over this lien on the property, in the non-real property, I'm doing this in a way that it's not asmachta, I'm doing gmir sadats, the full-fledged lien on the property. So they have to, in order to strengthen the shtar, to make it like a full-fledged star, a full-fledged sale, or full-fledged matana, instead of just being a mashkon, he has to say this lashon, that it's not an asmachta, and it's not ketuf sed shtare, and it's not just like a star here, it's a contract that's used for writing other contracts, like a template of a contract. Here it's a real contract that was written in the, for the purpose, the sole purpose of generating a lien on this real property along with the non-real property, and therefore you can do it. So if that's the case, we should always be worried about him being nogeh be'eduto, even by metaltelin. Where it says, "Ach ma'iskinech kol kach kach umachar the altar." He purchased the object and sold it right away. So we know that he didn't have any chance to make collateralize this item. So where it says, "V'leichus dilma de iknehu." Well, why don't we worry about the fact that he had already collateralized anything he's going to buy in the future? He says, "Listen, you take this property with a lien on it, and anything I buy in the future will be included in his lien." So why don't we worry about that? The Gemara says, well, there, from there we can say, Shmat Mina, that a person who says, the Ikne, that in the future, anything that comes into my possession will be given over to you, or you'll be part of this kinyan, then, Kanau Machar, Kanav Orish, Lo Mishtabit. If he goes ahead and purchases it, and sells it, and purchases it, and then passes away and gives it to his children, there is no lien here, the lien doesn't work. So it happens to be subject to Machlokas later on in the Gemara. And over here, the Gemara says, if you're going to say what you're saying over here, that he can just, if we know that he sold it right away, bought it and sold it right away, that there is no lien over here. The underlying assumption is that one cannot create future liens at this time, meaning that something I'll buy in the future will be enjoined to this lien, that you can't do. So the Rashi says from our Gemara, it seems like that's the conclusion to the case, but the Gemara here doesn't reverse it, and there's no other conclusion of the Gemara. Rashi wants to pass in here. The Gemara here moves on and said, leaves that alone and says, maybe, you know, maybe that is the case, but I want to give a solution that doesn't force me to be locked into that answer. And what is that? We've made them that come and testify that this person never owned any land. If he never owned any land, then we don't have ever a problem. If he never owned land, he can't do any kinyan agav. If he can't do a kinyan agav, there's no lien that can ever be exerted over these metaltalim. And that'll be the answer, that he never owned land. It's an amazing Tosos here that discusses this problem. There is a shita that was prevalent amongst the, it's as to be as the Gonim and Rishonim, that people used to write Harsha'ot, and Harsha'ot they used to write that they had property, and there was a kinyan agav the property. But these people clearly didn't own any property. So how were they writing into documents that they had property if they didn't have property? So the answer of these people was that they actually did have property. You know where their property was? Every person owns 4 amot in Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, Klal Yisrael as a whole has a hold on Eretz Yisrael. And since I'm a member of Klal Yisrael, there is somewhere in Eretz Yisrael which is my property. And since karka is ain't an exelet, it's never stolen, so since it was originally my property, and someone else might be residing on it or taking it, but it's not stolen, I'm going to exert my ownership over it one day. Therefore, enecha da'am she'en lo da'al ramot. Every person has a da'al ramot. Or the other ploy that people played was that, oh, every person has 4 amot, and what is that? That's a place that he is going to be buried in the future. Because we say that a mace is kone the makom, where he's buried, the 4 amot around it. So in the future, I will own land because I'm going to die and I'm going to have to be buried, so I'm going to have 4 amot. So the Tosafot says that that's the explanation of some, that that was the ploy that they used to say that when in contracts where they needed to own karka, kodyonim, where they needed karka, even though they didn't have karka, we'd assume they had karka because they must have karka in Eretz Yisrael, they must have karka because they're going to die and they're going to have a kever. Tosafot says, I can prove to you from our Gemara, that's not true. Because here we have Edim saying that he never owned karka. What do you mean he never owned karka? According to these Rishonim or these Gonim that explain it that way, you always own karka. There's no chance that you don't own karka. So if that's the case, I can prove to you that they're wrong. So now the Gemara, then he says, well, then how do we solve the problem? How do we create these contracts where these people have no karka, right, or go ahead and write into the contract? They have karka, we're koning them agava karka, or they give money. So that he quotes the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam actually is found in Ksubos also. And the Rabbeinu Tam is in a context, some other context over there, which is that what happens in Ketubot? We know that in Ketubah that the Baal, the husband, promises to his wife a whole bunch of money. And on top of that, we give old money. There's a dowry on top of that. And we know the guy's penniless. The guy has no money. So how are we offering to the woman all this money? And where it's Meshubat? How are we Meshabed himself to give this money to the woman? True. If he had the money or had the karka, we can say the shibud's on that, and anything he sells and buys after that, right, the lien transfers onto those items. But if he didn't have anything to start with, then there's no lien. Then how can you transfer the lien? The lien doesn't exist. It's davar shelo bali olam. So the Rabbeinu Tam answers over there, and the Rabbeinu Tam gives the same answer over here. What we say, what's called hodat baldin kimei ha'edim tanmi. If an individual says that he owns karka, even though we have edim testifying otherwise, we don't listen to him. We say that his admission that he has karka, or his writing that he has karka, we're going to believe him. We're going to create this fiction that it really exists, that he does have karka. That might go back to what we explained before about what is hodat baldin kmei edim, that we mean. That meaning that we were some and said that was just a procedural way to give a psak. The others say, no, that's koveya the mitziyut. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam seems to be saying over here. It's koveya the mitziyut. If the baldin comes along and says, I have karka, we don't make any more questions. He has karka now. So now we can do anything we want. We can have a ketubah where he owes money in excess of what he owns. He can have our shah that says that he has karka because that's what he said. He says he has karka. Because he says he has karka, therefore we don't have any more questions. Now the Gemara continues. V'amar Papa, afgav damar rabbanan amuchesed de chaviro shelo b'achrayut. Ubal b'chol b'tarfein chuzer lav. Nimtze chenu shelo chuzer lav. Wait a minute. That depends how the sale works. Meaning that if you sell something to a person, an individual, and you do not accept recourse, if the property is taken away from the individual who purchased it from you, from by a creditor or by someone else, then he has no recourse. He can't go back to the original owner and make a claim against him because that's exactly why he sold it. He sold it to you without recourse in order to be protected from such an incident. Ah, you bought it and you paid money. The Gemara says people can buy for a day, for 2 days. People will buy for the temporary benefit they'll get till the property is taken away from them. People do that all the time. It's a risk they'll assume and they're willing to buy it. They'll discount it in the price, but they will make such a purchase. But on the other hand, if the property is taken away from you because the person who sold you didn't really own it, he was a gazlan or he really never had proper title to it to sell it to you, in that case you do have recourse against him. Because there the property has been taken not because of risk that you assumed, but because the whole sale, the whole premise of the sale was false. If the whole premise of the sale was false, then you can go back and get your money back from the person who sold it to you. Because if the party here, or the third party, Yehuda, comes along successful, taking away from the lokeach, from the buyer over here, the buyer can now go back to the mocher, to the seller, and make a claim on his property. He can say, listen, give me my money back. So now the seller, in our case it was Shimon always all along, he's the seller, he has a vested interest in seeing the property stay in the hands of the buyer. Because, again, if it was a creditor, he wouldn't care, and he's not Gebe Duto. But he is no Gebe Duto if the person's coming along claiming that it was never owned by the person who sold it. Because then, if it's taken from the buyer, he has a vested interest here. So the Gemara says, no problem. That answer, we can answer that. That the buyer knows for certain that was the seller's property. He has some evidence, he knows for certain that it is. So there's no question here about whether the buyer thinks the mocher cheated him out or didn't own the property. If that's the case, the buyer is not going to have any recourse against the seller. If that's true, then the seller can go and testify on behalf of the buyer because he's no longer nogeya be'eduto. Rav Zvid says, against Rav Papa's position before, that afilo nimtzei cheino shelo eno chozer olav. Rav Zvid says that when it comes to a case where you sell without recourse, not only are you protected, the seller is not only protected for a case where the creditor comes along or some other claimant comes along and takes the property, but you're even protected if someone comes along and says you never owned it. You sold it without the right to sell it because you never owned it. So Rav Papa suggests in that case there is recourse, even if you said there was no recourse. Zid says no. If he says no recourse, he means no recourse. There's no recourse even in a case like this. That's exactly why I sold it to you without recourse. I sold it to you without recourse to protect me from any situation. any situation includes situations where someone comes along and says it wasn't yours to sell. So when you bought it, you got to know, you got to include in the price the risk that this property wasn't mine, or this property is going to be, could be taken by a creditor. And once you've done that, I have no, you have no recourse against me. I have no responsibility towards you. In that case, of course, according to Rav Zvid, it's easy to explain now why he's not nogea be'eduto. He's not nogea be'eduto because there is no recourse against the original owner. So now, in order to explain our Braisa, this is what the Gemara has now concluded. We explained the Braisa on Daf Mem Gimel and Bet. We explained it based on Rabin Bar Shmuel. Rabin Bar Shmuel teaches us that the disownership or your removal of your ownership only is good prospectively, but retroactively, meaning looking backwards, that is not the case because the creditors or anybody else who had a claim before the time that it was sold have rights to the property, and therefore you have a vested interest in that property. Now, when is that true? Again, we explained that that's only true when it's real property. That's why the Braisa says if you sold a sadeh or a bayit, right, then in that case, you have achrayuto, there's a problem because you can, the other person, there's recourse. I mean, there's the ability of the creditor to go after this item. The creditor can go after this item, then we know that you have vested interest in keeping it in the hands of the buyer, because then your creditors can go and get the money from them. But if you don't keep it in the hands of the buyer, then the creditors will come to you, and they're going to have a separate claim. So therefore, you have a vested interest. On the other hand, if it's metaltim, there's no lien on metaltim. There's no lien on metaltim. When you sell the item, you're out. You're gone. It's all gone. Once it's gone from your possession, your creditors can't go after it. You can't go after it. It's all gone. Once it's gone, you're not no gea beduto anymore, and therefore you can testify in those cases. And again, metaltim will be free and clear of any liens. If they're free and clear of any liens, you cannot, then you're not nogea beduto. You can testify on behalf of the buyer because you're going to get no benefit from that remaining in the hands of the buyer. And the conditions for the metaltalim to be free and clear of you being nogea beduto are, one, we either said that he bought and sold the metaltalim right away, so there's no chance of doing a kinyan agav. That assumes that you can't do a kinyan agav into the future. Number two, the other possibility which drops that first one and says that we have edim testifying that you never owned property. Or the third, and even when we have edim that testify that you don't own the property, we say that to qualify that statement is only a case where the recipient or the buyer says, I know for sure that the seller owned it. Otherwise, the buyer has recourse against the seller, and then, of course, he becomes a vested party or interested party again. That's according to Rav Papa. According to Rav Zvid, then you could, since you can never, the buyer has no rights to ever go after the seller, then you're never an interested party. It's sufficient to say that you did not have karka. Okay, we'll stop over here.